Welcome from me, John Strickland, to Our Future Skies in partnership with AIG. In this podcast series, I'm talking with a number of leading players from different parts of the airline industry. I'm exploring with them a range of views on where it might be headed and looking ahead in a time frame of 10 to 20 years. It's certainly an incredibly challenging time for the industry, still being affected by the ongoing aftermath of the COVID pandemic, which at least we hope is over, military conflict in Ukraine, and significant economic uncertainties. On top of this, there's a noticeable change in the political outlook in many parts of the world. And of course, when it comes to the subject of the environment and sustainability, aviation is very much center stage, understandably attracting ever more attention. In this episode, we're going to hear how these and future challenges may influence the low-cost segment of the airline business with the CEO of EasyJet, Johan Lundgren. Johan has had a long career in the travel industry. He's held senior positions in Europe's largest travel group, TUI, and he joined EasyJet as CEO in December 2017. So, welcome, Johan.
Thank you very much, John.
Well, before we kick off and look at some of the wider issues concerning the future of the sector, let's just take a look at EasyJet for a few moments. And I was reflecting, Johan, it's quite incredible to me that the airline was founded way back in 1995 by entrepreneur Stelios Hadjiannou. It was really quite a maverick airline when it came on the scene. It had just a couple of leased aircraft. The advertising slogan was making flying as affordable as a pair of jeans. And it also really marked the birth of direct sales through the internet. It also cut out travel agents, saying that it offered no free lunch to those agents. So you've really come a long way since that time now to being one of Europe's leading, not just low-cost airlines, but airlines, period, with a fleet of over 300 aircraft. So if you want to just give us a bit of an update on where you are today, Johan.
Well, it's interesting. I was doing a base visit in Nice the other day, and I tried to go and see one of our bases at least every other week. And I was telling them, as it was part of a 10-year anniversary, and reminded them that the strategy of the company today and the purpose of the company today is, you know, almost exactly what it was when it started. We see ourselves as the original democratizer of travel. Our purpose is making low-cost travel easy, and we want to be Europe's most loved airline. And, you know, most people wouldn't remember that today, but you would certainly know that, and I would know that before the deregulation, you know, the travel and flying was really for privileged and wealthy people. And we set out, as you said, to make this accessible for everyone. And I think now, strangely enough, you come after all these years and you recognize that purpose of making low-cost travel easy and accessible for millions and millions of people is probably even more important now, where we see huge inflationary cost pressures in the UK, squeezed on households from a financial perspective as well. So, you know, clearly the purpose and what we're trying to achieve and have achieved is still very, very relevant. And when it comes to where we stand today, we set out coming into the pandemic that, you know, we don't know for how long this is going to last, but we know that success will look like if we can come out of this in a stronger fashion relatively than we were coming into this versus our competitors. And I think that still holds true. We have one of the lowest net debt of any European airline, investment grade balance sheet, 3.6 billion of cash and 4.7 billion of liquidity, and just had one of the strongest financial quarter from an EBITDA point of view. So, you know, we're in a good place to continue this. But as you said, you know, clearly it's been rocky. If you just go back, you know, these 2.5 years ago, who would have thought the years that we had in front of us?
Well, indeed, as you alluded there in your answer, Johan, a number of challenges around us now, and we have to take a look into the future at what else may be happening. Certainly, it's a very different world from the one in which Easy began with, you could say, the flippancy of that advertising slogan about cheapness as compared to a pair of jeans. So let's now look at the priorities of today and get stuck into some of the meaty topics, starting with one you mentioned there, the COVID pandemic. As I said in my introduction, hopefully the worst is behind us, but we simply don't know. And the extent of the crisis was something of magnitude of which we'd never seen before. There was no comparison we could make. What was your initial reaction as that began to hit and we could see things were closing down, Johan?
Well, I let me embarrass myself to tell you what I said to the board just I think a couple of months before the breakout of this. I said to the board, look, I can almost guarantee you that this is going to be the best year ever in the company history. I think about that sometimes and reflect on the fact that, you know, how little you actually know what's happening in the future. But I think that, you know, there were a couple of things that we decided on early on that proved to be right. We said, in contrast to some other airlines, that one, we don't know for how long this is going to last. So cash is going to be absolutely key. We need to make sure that we have liquidity, and we have raised a huge amount of cash throughout the pandemic because we simply didn't know where it was going to end. And we couldn't second guess also the not, you know, just to mention the virus in itself, but also the other dimension, which was the travel restrictions. I mean, there was a huge difference in terms of how stringent they were and how damaging they were, where UK was the one who was, you know, the toughest when it came to travel restrictions. And what I think many people in the UK doesn't know is that, you know, most of Europe were certainly throughout, you know, certain peers were flying and back up as normal. So, and being UK largest airline, we were, you know, very damaged about that. But cash and liquidity was something that was a priority to reduce the cash burn and to stop the losses, because we wanted to make sure that the cash lasted. And also then, you know, that we did what we could in terms of getting ourselves ready for the recovery. So we did a huge changes around those three priorities, really. And I think that the difficulty was the starts and stops that we saw. You know, by this time last year, things were looking really well, if you remember, John. And then we came to Omicron, and then, you know, restrictions were still then reintroduced in the UK. And even in early January, the government couldn't tell us what restriction would be in place or not be in place for the summer. So the last set of restrictions were only removed in March, which made it incredibly difficult, which is well documented clearly on how to, you know, get going with a successful recovery in the summer.
Well, I think you've really set the scene perfectly there, Johan, for all the challenges that this virus brought us in the industry. If we kind of try to project that into the future, touching on a couple of the points you've made, I mean, how might we do things differently? You know, what learnings could there be? Particularly, you talked there about the challenge of liquidity, and I wanted to ask you, do you think not only EasyJet, but do you think the industry has to find a different approach to liquidity management so that it can make sure it has the necessary buffers and the robustness financially for any other major future shock of this nature?
Well, I think it's very dependent on the airline and the company you're talking about. As I said, we were, you know, privileged to come in at this as one of the strongest airlines. We had an investment balance sheet order then. But I think the fact that we took the decision early on to say, look, we're going to need to go out and make sure we have, you know, as much liquidity as possible. So I think we raised over, which has been really tough and it's been difficult decisions, but over £7 billion since the start of the pandemic. And in contrast to some of our competitors, we're not backed up by any government, and we don't get any preferential treatment, and neither would we want to have that either. We operate on commercial terms, and I think it's more down to the fact that how well managed the various companies are. And of course, if you are in that category, you wouldn't want to see that subsidies or undue support is given to somebody else. I mean, market forces needs to have, you know, plays role. But from a liquidity point of view, I think one should be careful to try to, you know, regulate that more than it is, because I like to see that, you know, commercial and viable and strong companies, they should survive. They should have a benefit for being fiscally prudent. And if you're not, you shouldn't be given, you know, undue support.
Yeah, and one other angle I think is interesting, Johan, because there was no way to prepare for this when we didn't know it was coming. As you said, you were expecting a good year 2 months prior to it happening. But one thing that seems to have evolved and become more important to me for the future is technology. You know, the industry had to respond. It had to throw out a lot of its processes, and particularly in terms of planning, schedules, pricing and so on, and everything looking towards the future was inevitably based on historic information. EasyJet is a digital airline par excellence. I guess digital played a role and would play a role even more in the future in managing a major crisis.
Yes, and I mean it's an interesting aspect of it, and I come to think of two examples, which is slightly different, but it still evolves, you know, the digital and the data capability of a company, and as you said, I think we've been in the forefront in many of these areas, but when we came into the first part of this pandemic, and when we grounded, if you remember the whole of the fleet. We you know, could clearly see the absolute need for customers to be able to self-service. When you then had the virus who created a lockdown in the places where we had the call centers and contact centers in India and South Africa, you just realize how absolutely important it was for customers to be able to self-service themselves. So as we then continued through the pandemic, and whilst there was a lot of projects who was put on ice because you simply needed to save the money and the cash, we completely reinvented the ability for customers to self-service. So today, it is about 80% of every transaction you can possibly think of the customers can do. They can do themselves by the app or via their own devices. So that digitalization has, you know, been accelerated really because of the necessity that we found to deal with it. But the other point I was going to say, the other example is that when you're looking at things like pricing, it's really interesting because we have a very much a data-led, you know, approach onto pricing and demand-led approach to the pricing. And we have about, you know, 600 different profiles from an algorithm point of view that we apply when we're looking how to maximize the revenue per seat. But of course, John, you know, almost all of them are based on historical data, mm-hmm. and historical patterns. And those patterns aren't there anymore to that extent. So you can clearly see the need that exists actually not only then to work with data and digital from a historical knowledge point of view, but actually then predict future demand based on other types of evidence, competitor capacity that, you know, is publicized, for instance, now into the summer to some extent, competitor pricing that is available also then for the summer, to look more at that and look at recent trading and recent demand pattern in order for them to really be adjusting the algorithms. So it's really, you know, interesting also to see what has happened on something that used to be a very demand-led, stable environment where you can track your prices and your trading and project very much what it's going to be based on historical data that just simply isn't relevant anymore to that extent.
I mean, we're fortunate in that sense to be in that digital age. If this had happened even 20, 30 years prior, we wouldn't have been able to manipulate in the way we do with this data. Just turning to one last question in relation to the pandemic, and again, looking to the future, we've seen the manpower challenges coming out of COVID. Perhaps the industry didn't expect the number of people it had employed to leave permanently. Certainly many people lost their jobs, had to be furloughed, but the expectation would be people would come back. We're in a tight labor market currently, but we can't tell what kind of labor market we'll have in 10 or 20 years' time. But do you think the industry has learned or is needing to learn to reappraise what it offers to people? Is it the romantic, sexy industry we perhaps thought it was, that people would always come knocking on the door for a job? What's going to be the right approach for that in the future, do you think, Johan?
It's a very good point. And once again, you know, when I go out and speak to our crew and at our bases, you know, you do have people who started and they joined the company here like in May. And certainly some of them had a lot of challenges in the beginning. But I would say that the overwhelming part of those people who began then was saying that, look, this is exceptionally fun. This is interesting. It's not as bad as I thought it was when I read in the press. You know, so clearly, I think still the industry has an attractiveness to it whilst you're in it. But of course, if you're standing on the outside and you've been looking at some of the headlines and you're looking certainly about some of the challenges that the whole of the sector has had, particularly in the UK, you might think that, well, you know, this might not be an industry for me as well. So look, if you're interested in travel, you're interested in meeting people, you're interested in in you know, having the opportunity to make an impact on people's livelihoods for the better as well, I still believe that this industry has a lot to offer also going forward.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah. Let's turn to the actual mix of airlines in the industry, airline business models. We've got a whole variety, I would say, and it's not just because I'm speaking to you, that low cost is arguably the most successful, but others, we have, for example, hub carriers, we have long haul low cost, even today, ultra long haul airlines. Do you think we'll see a change in the composition of business models in the industry in the decades ahead?
Well, clearly what you're seeing now, at least, is that the business models that exist, whether you're hub and spoke or a low-cost point-to-point airline, are being very much clearer and much more focused. I think that the legacy carriers realize, one, that coming out of this pandemic, they have become even more uncompetitive on the short-haul network. And at the same time, they're making quite a lot of money on the long-haul and premium leisure. So they are clearly focusing a lot of attention on that long-haul premium segment, which then means that the attention to their short-haul network is of less interest. And it's there primarily now working as a feeder into their hubs. Which the impact is then for us, which we clearly can see that there's been a huge retrenchment of capacity from long-haul airlines from that short-haul network, which provides an opportunity clearly for us that we've certainly taken. We managed to get 3 aircraft worth of slots in Lisbon, as an example, which is a constrained airport, which is something we're really, you know, pleased about. And I think that will continue. So I think that the primary excitement that exists in the boardrooms at the legacy airline is around the fact that they are managing now to charge an absolute fortune for the premium long-haul segment. But secondly, when they're sobering up, they're going to try to realize that, you know, what on earth are we going to do with this unprofitable short-haul operation that we have? And that provides, either way you look at it, clearly an opportunity for ourselves.
So definitely more scope for low-cost airlines to grow, as you say there, around the European short-haul board. Do you look perhaps to change strategy in the future? You've got a fleet of aircraft which, as new deliveries come in, are going to allow potential to fly further. Some of the models of Airbus's A321, which are available to you perhaps in the future. I mean, you could effectively do long-haul. We see some of the competitor airlines are looking at that to an extent. Might you look at that for the future? Do you think others will? Or do you think you'll be more inclined to stick to what you know and make that work, but do more of it?
No, absolutely stick to what we're doing. Because we are EasyJet is Europe's second largest airline. And we're the largest airlines from the primary airport. You know, so our absolute focus is just to grow our presence in many cases where we already exist. I'm much more keen to go from a base of 5 aircraft to make that 6 or 7 rather than to chase a new market and start up something new. I mean, we still own, even if we're of this size, you know, depending on how you look at it, we still only have 5% market share or something like that, or 10% market share, depending on what you look at. And, you know, come back to me when I have 30% market share to say that, look, you're running out of scope here. what do you need to do? Our course, it's extraordinary, you know, and to a huge extent on our presence at the primary airport and the slot-constrained airport. That's where we want to grow our presence. And I don't think it is clear that, for instance, low-cost airlines going into long-haul is an attractive, you know, business proposition. I can see it from a customer point of view, particularly with the prices that is now being charged by some. But you know, the fact remains that the longer you are in the air, the less of the efficiencies that you have because of the low-cost model with short turnaround times and so on, you know, disappears for every hour that you're up in the air. So short-haul really has, low-cost has a real advantage versus legacy short-haul because of the efficiencies for short flights, which is the normal, you know, 2 to 2.5 hour sectors.
And what about startups, Johan? I mean, the pandemic has brought a swathe of new startups. Do you think there will be the same taste in the decades ahead for new people, new approaches to come into the industry? There hasn't been a shortage of entrepreneurs who think they can have a go at this. pretty well through history of the industry, but most of them actually failed. Do you think that trend's going to continue in the years ahead?
Oh, gosh. I mean, if you're crazy enough that you have so much money that you think that this is a good time to start up in an airline without any presence in this environment, I wish them the best of luck. And as you said, you know, a lot of them has also disappeared and left the stage. So I doubt you're going to see that. And the question is then, well, if you and I were starting up an airline today, where would you go? Because you can't get into the most in-demand slots at the, you know, constrained airports. So then you would again go into go to places on, you know, airports you can hardly pronounce, so you don't know really where they are on the map. And then, you know, we know this is quite a big competition over there from the likes of Ryanair and others, and you just couldn't get in somewhere else. I just wouldn't know where you would spot that there was an opportunity for you to deliver something that somebody else isn't doing. You can certainly do it from a regional point of view. And of course, you can see that there will be regional carriers who could, you know, fill a vacuum of somebody who's pulled out. But at scale, I doubt it.
I mean, it's interesting to reflect, I suppose, you know, and EasyJet itself was indeed a startup and was, as I mentioned earlier, a maverick airline. But I guess it was a different world. It certainly wasn't born at a time of a crisis as we see today. So I guess it depends what moment in history somebody decides to have a go.
Yes, but remember that the characteristics of the environment at that point in time was the deregulation. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you didn't have the constraints at the airports that existed, you know, in the primary location the way it does today. So the fact that you now had a, you know, level playing field on a number of carriers who were just simply too inefficient, that was a clear opportunity. But that doesn't really exist today because you can't get into those airports anymore with a sizable program and compete. So then you're left to go to, you know, really secondary and tertiary airports. And then you're, you know, clearly you got less, you know, catchment of people in that area. And there's still quite a lot of competition of the effective airlines.
Absolutely. A fair point, Johan. What about the shape of demand itself in the years ahead? You've already alluded to some of the changes we're seeing now, particularly on the long haul side of the business with more premium leisure traffic. What shape do you think demand might be in the next 10 or 20 years? I mean, low-cost airlines, as you said, traditionally, their raison d'etre is to sell on price, but selling on price doesn't mean any one type of customer. You sell to a range of people, be they business, leisure, or visiting friends or relations. What do you think we might see happening? Do you believe in this apparent emergence of what is being called bleisure, a mix of business and leisure? And what about the generational side of it, the Gen Zers? Are they going to want to travel as much or differently?
Well, so if you break it down a little bit, I mean, first of all, you're looking at the pricing, because you're right. I mean, the pricing is a key component when it comes to, you know, people's preference of choosing airlines to travel with on short haul. And you know, all of us is going to, one, trying to recover the cost increases we've seen. Of course, we're going to need to do that, and they are quite substantial. I do think also from a demand point of view that the leisure travel, you're going to see two things happening. You're going to have one part of the clientele who's going to book earlier than ever because they want to get a, you know, hold of the really good deals that is out there. But you're also going to have people who's going to wait because of uncertainty in, you know, what disposable income they will have available at that point in time. So the booking pattern will come even later than before. We know that people will prioritize as their, you know, for the time of the squeeze on households, they're going to prioritize to do their holidays. We know that they're going to prioritize all inclusive as an example. They're going to prioritize destinations where they get a lot of money. So the currencies matters. We know that in times of uncertainty, they're going to gravitate more towards brands that they trust. They're not likely to take chances on unknown players and unknown travel companies and unknown airlines. You're going to see it from a business travel point of view. And we've already seen that the SMEs is coming back with their business travel much quicker than the larger corporations. They don't have the same type of travel policies and the travel restrictions that has been set up by large corporations. the groups of business travel is going to look different. You're going to see that there will be travel taking place, but it will not be, you know, the same amount. Previously, you could have a group going out with a CEO or CFO or two, three other people. It's going to be fewer people traveling these parties. So there will be a change and there will be a mix of these things, but we know the travel, you know, will still be in demand on both these segments. And actually, the business traveler is the one that has accelerated the most for us in the last couple of months.
What about the concept of pleasure, though, Johan? That's something I find quite interesting, because I know as we talk today, you're remote, you're not in your office today. I saw somebody put something on social media just a few days ago saying, I've worked from home in 70 different countries. So they really were getting around the world using their digital nomad computer approach. Do you think we're going to see that accelerate? Is that something you predict and that you'd look to tap into?
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I spoke to a hotelier who has a large hotel chain in the Mediterranean here just a couple of weeks ago. And he said that he were now, you know, looking to invest in his facilities to be able to accommodate for that. That people will actually do, you know, work and have that, you know, set up from a work environment with, you know, the connections that is needed and the facilities that is needed at the same time as they're there and they can be on holiday. I mean, it's interesting. You previously, you know, you think about it in a way that you went into the office, and one of the reasons and the purpose of going into office was that you're going to meet people. Well, many companies go into the office today and there's nobody there. So we actually don't meet people. So,
that's a good point.
Well, the whole point of saying, and I know, you know, and we're no exception when we're looking about, you know, our working practices, that if you're coming into the office, I don't know, 3 days a week or something like that, and you suddenly find yourself that one of those days you're just sitting in Teams and Zoom calls anyway. What's the point? So I think one has to, you know, think of it in this way, that as your company, if you ask people to come into their offices, you also got to earn their commute in a way. Somebody said that, and I thought that sounded quite logical. You know, it's got to be worthwhile to do that. So you're setting up the work experience in the offices, whatever that might be, that you're actually there to see people.
And what about generationally? You know, we hear a lot about the Gen Z outlook on life today, quite pragmatic, more willing to busk along, I suppose. I mean, I'm a bit perhaps too far removed from that generation to speak authoritatively, but they seem to have a different outlook. Is it going to be a good one from a point of view of travel and the airline business?
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about that. I mean, you should remember that prior to the pandemic, there's been a whole generation who's been brought up in a way where travel wasn't a big deal. I mean, many thanks part to companies such as ourselves. It didn't cost a fortune. It was convenient. It was just something that they could go and see friends, and they could go on a holiday. They could go for a couple of days, and they could see their parents if they live somewhere else. And that's just part of life. Then comes the pandemic where everybody's, you know, to a large extent, particularly in the UK, hasn't been able to travel. But you're not going to get rid of, you know, that underlying demand that exists for people to go out and see things and do things and explore things. It's ultimately within us as human beings to do, and that will continue. And I don't know how many times I got questions on interviews throughout the pandemic when we were in lockdown and travel restrictions. Oh, do you ever think that travel is going to come back to what it was? Well, we saw summer.
Absolutely. I mean, I was very skeptical. I mean, it's come back way quicker, way, way more with a vengeance than I ever imagined.
Yeah.
Let's turn to a different topic. The big one, which we can't avoid and we can't do justice to in this podcast, or we'd be talking for hours, but it is the essential one. And that, of course, is the topic of the environment and sustainability. I know it's something that you've got strong views on. Just want to put a couple of philosophical rather than technical questions to you, Johan. I mean, you're a Swede. I do quite a bit of work in Scandinavia myself, and I know the Scandinavian mentality is very, very focused on the environment. First of all, do you think that informs your own views on the subject? And secondly, could it be a bit of a wild card in certain countries? I know in Sweden we've seen almost a boycott to an extent of some domestic air travel. There are strong feelings about air travel's role in the challenge of the climate.
Yeah, I would certainly think that the way I was brought up and in that environment that that has colored me, and you know, despite me living in the UK since 2009, yeah, I always felt strongly about these things as well. And I think most people in Scandinavian countries has learned that from when you were young. I mean, I was born at 66, as an example, and I remember the campaigns there was in schools that you should pick up and you should clean up on the streets, you should never throw anything. And there was always this, you know, focus around keeping, you know, the nature in good shape and don't waste anything to the extent that was possible. So I think that has always been part of me and everyone else who'd been brought up in that environment. And that's not the same when you're coming into, you know, some other cultures and countries for various reasons. But I think that to that extent, this was something that EasyJet had done, you know, well before I joined as well. And partly it was, and it is a commercial decision, not only from the fact that it's the primarily the right thing to do, but, you know, why would you want to waste, you know, fuel that costs a lot of money that then in its turn releases dangerous, you know, emissions? Easy that we cut the carbon intensity from 2000 to 2020 with some over 30%. And it was very much driven by the fact that, you know, there's a cost saving here, but it's also the right thing to do. And I think that has always been part of what we want to do and want to achieve. I mean, it's like one third of what we're doing is the cost of fuel that we're having. And that's a substantial part. If you reduce that, you're in better shape and the nature's in a better shape as well.
And maybe going beyond your own network, Johan, do you think philosophically we might see a bit of a divide around the world, geographically or even at a national level, in desire to travel, perhaps with the old world, so to speak, thinking particularly of Europe and the US retrenching, and the new world, of course, hungry for growth. If we look at countries like India and China, you know, how might that play out and how do we square those differences in outlook?
Well, I mean, it is true, and I saw some numbers on that. I can't remember the exact numbers there, but I think it was only like 4 or 5% of the world's population who has ever been taking a flight. So it tells you how very focused this is on relatively few people on the planet, which you can look at then in two ways. You can look to say, well, you know, what happens when the 95% will go and start taking on flights as prosperity are evolved in some of these places, hopefully, as an example. But I think that, you know, you cannot deny the fact that there's a huge also acceleration in terms of the technologies that is now starting to become available when it comes to zero emissions, as an example. And you know, the roadmap we presented to net zero by 2050, and we were the first, you know, airline, you know, with a low-cost model who announced that roadmap that was verified by the Science Based Target Initiative, that stipulates for the first time now that we can start taking these technologies, you know, into our fleet. Get to 2050.
But just to round up on the philosophical side of it, as you said, there's a bit of an opposing outlook in different parts of the world. But two other elements I just want to discuss briefly in a philosophical sense are, do you think there's a challenge that the industry is not all on the same page about what it's doing right now? We see different views, and linked to that, low-cost airlines in particular, you know, we mentioned earlier on the one hand, low-cost airlines have been real democratizers of travel. But is it all about growth? Is it all about expansion? And is that not going to give some challenges for the future?
Yeah, but I think that there's a difference. First of all, I don't think that there's anyone from the industry in Europe, certainly, who has the view that did exist from some just 3-4 years ago, that we need to restrict flying. I think there was one CEO of KLM who said that, you know, we need to fly less. But that was just purely self-interest because they didn't have growth prospects in front of them. But, you know, my view, and I think most people's view, well, all people that I speak to, other CEOs in Europe would say, of course, we can fly and we should fly more, because don't forget the massive benefits that come from flying. I mean, the improvements in people's livelihoods, the economies, and the contribution it delivers towards societies as well. So we want to keep all of that and we want to grow that. But at the same time, we want to decarbonize. We want to reduce the impact on the environment. And now you can see that those technologies are becoming available. So I don't think there's anybody, at least in Europe, who doesn't think that growth is still an important element of what we can do, because growth is ultimately good if you do it in a responsible way. And, you know, certainly all the competitors that I speak to are convinced about that, which wasn't really what I heard some people were saying here, or, you know, only some years ago. But that's because technology has evolved. If you're then looking into other sectors in the industry from a geographical point of view, I mean, they would be just, you know, further behind than we are in Europe. A4E, as you know, were the first organization who set out to become net zero by 2050, who really, you know, drove this. I was the chairman here the other year, and that work started before I was chairman of the organization. But we all signed up and committed to that. And then you saw that US airlines were following. And then you saw also there were movements in the APAC area as well of other airlines. So I think everybody's going to go into this trend. But what is quite, and this is an important point, what is really irritating and I get frustrated about is that because some, not only airlines, but also OEMs, you know, manufacturers are more progressed than others and less progressed than others. The ones who are less progressed than others on this new technology, they are the one who kind of spreads this idea that, oh, these type of zero emissions technologies, they will not happen for a very long period of time, and because X, Y, Z, that's because they just haven't done their work.
Well, you touched on an interesting point there, Johan, and let's have a fairly brisk look at some very important issues, and we'll have to do another podcast, I think, specifically on the environment. But as you say, technology is moving along. There is a challenge, I think we can't deny, in terms of technology, whether it is power sources, hydrogen, electric, more efficient engines using those power sources for larger aircraft. But that doesn't mean no work is going on. You, as you said, have laid out a roadmap recently, moving EasyJet's position quite significantly to investment and research in technology at a fast pace with partners, including Airbus and Rolls-Royce. But as you said, not everybody buys into it. So your hypothesis is really that is largely because other people are not doing the same thing to the same extent. Is that part of a challenge, would you say?
Of course it is. But they are badly informed. I'm sorry to say that. And I will tell them every time. And every time this to debate this, I just tell them that, look, you're working with the wrong suppliers. They haven't taken this serious. You haven't taken this serious. I mean, we you know, at EasyJet, and you know, personally as well, I'm hugely interested in the technology aspect of this whole thing. And I can see the opportunities that exist. But, you know, today we know that we're going to have, for instance, you know, a short-haul network in Europe that will be primarily driven by hydrogen in whether that is 15, 20, 25 years from now. It's more a matter about timing than the fact that we know it's going to happen. Even 3 years, 4 years ago, people will say that, well, in the industry, well, it won't work because of X, Y, and Z. And what people always do, the mistake is that they don't think of the development technology as being exponential. They think it's linear, and they can't see what's going to happen in the future. But there's huge amounts of work that's been done to accelerate these technologies. And of course, when those players then say to media and to the stakeholders, because they haven't done their work, or they're not committed to the work, and they're not, you know, just informed, right, that, oh, I have doubts that this will happen. Of course, that gets reflected then in the debate about it, which is the thing that has frustrated me the most when we started really on this journey here, which was before the pandemic, by the way. But what you then need to do, you just need to prove them wrong. And I think that's what we've been doing. And a good testament to that is the roadmap to 2050 that we launched here just recently.
Well, so now I'd encourage listeners to take a look at that, which is available, I know, through your website. A lot of important research work going on there. We know one element, Johan, that we are going to have to rely on is to move away from fossil fuels with SAFs, sustainable aviation fuels. A key question there, and not to go into the weeds of this topic, but are you optimistic we can get to scale, and how might we do that? and particularly here in Europe, because I wonder, you know, is Europe falling behind what the US is doing? I know there are big incentives from government to produce SAF fuel, and indeed for airlines to use it.
Well, it certainly looks like that right now. I think the US has accelerated the work on that. I mean, they have almost all their large airlines is depending on long haul, as an example. And we know that SAF will play a major role when it comes to decarbonization of the long haul, whereas zero emission technology like hydrogen will matter more when it comes to short haul. But I still, you know, I think that we still have yet to see more investments coming into the development of SAFs, and particularly also, you know, the latest generation of SAFs with power to liquid and e-fuels and so on. But that will take some resources. But it's the same thing when it comes to the production of low carbon hydrogen or even green hydrogen for that matter. We need to see that countries and governments are stepping up their investments onto the supply on this. But what's important to think about this, we're debating, you and I here now, about the supply of the energy source. We're not talking about whether the technology will work or not. We know it will work, and that's a massive step ahead. And then don't forget, when it comes to decarbonization, that there's still huge a lot of things that, you know, decision makers can still do. I forget about how many times I've been talking about the modernization of the airspace. You know, when are we going to see now an implementation of the single European sky in one shape or form or not? I mean, it would represent an over 10% decrease in carbon emissions just for EasyJet if that was implemented.
That topic has been going on for decades, hasn't it, to simplify European sky from an ATC point of view. And it leads me to ask you a question on two levels about the role of governments. One, in terms of their willingness to foster a zero-emission aviation industry against maybe an instinct perhaps to restrict. I mean, if we look at what happened after COVID hit us, it was straight away lock it down, you know, cut the industry back. We've seen recently the Dutch government with plans to cut capacity permanently at Amsterdam Schiphol Airport. How do you think this is going to play out between the need for a strong industry economically, and governments have to think about votes in that respect, and also their instinct to maybe hold back again for a political win?
I mean, the perception I have when I speak with ministers across the European governments is that there's much less of a narrative or signal now to restrict flying and travel. I think that was much stronger, you know, pandemic, because I think then that just fitted with everything that went on in terms of, you know, the restrictions that were in place in some cases. I think it's more now down to the fact that, look, how do you implement these technologies? And it's less about restrictions. You mentioned Schiphol as an example and Holland, but I think there are some particular challenges around why that fitted them to have that type of a you know, line. But I see less of now talks about, you know, we need to restrict travel and flying in order to achieve our target. I mean, my main counter argument to people who say that, and when we talk about the airspace modernization in general, I said, look, how much do you want this really and genuinely to reduce the emissions? Because you have the opportunity to make a decision together with other decision makers in the country that will, you know, reduce this by 10 to 15% as we speak. How much you really want this? How much of an urgency do you genuinely think that this is? Because if you do think it is, why isn't it happening? And one of the most strange arguments you get from them who still defends why this is difficult to implement is to say, well, we can't do it for security and for military reasons, because we need to protect the zones and the airspace in our, you know, countries and that exist there. But that's just proved to be nonsense. And you can see that with the terrible war in Ukraine, that the moment that the military wants to have access to the airspace, they take it within minutes. Mm-hmm. So the corridors could still be changed and modernized without that affecting any ability for any country to have their airspace available for military purposes or whatever that would be. So that argument is simply not there anymore. So I keep going on about this, and I you know, when I speak to ministers to say, look, how much do you genuinely want to decarbonize? Here you have 10 to 15% of carbon reduction sitting in front of you if you can get onto this. And then we, as airlines, we will certainly do our part as well.
And what about funding, just in brief? Who's going to pay for this? I mean, we're talking about billions of euros here in Europe alone, whether it is research into new technology, new fuels, scaling up SAFs and so on. Is it going to be the OEMs, in other words, the manufacturers? Is it going to be the airlines? Is it going to be governments? How is that going to play out? Airlines are not known for being flush with cash usually for anything other than essential investments in their own businesses.
Well, I mean, I think everybody needs to contribute to it. I mean, this is not something that's going to happen. And we can't, as an industry, expect, you know, the 100% of all the funding be coming in through government investments. And neither can the governments expect that this is just going to come in from the business. So everybody would need to contribute to that. But when everybody speaks about whatever estimates of the cost that I've seen, you know, about what reaching net zero will be to 2050, we keep forgetting about what the alternative cost is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the alternative cost is greater. So
absolutely,
you know, it's not like you really do have an option whether you should go down this route or not go down this route. This is about making sure you go down this route and you do it as quickly and as efficient as you possibly can.
And one last question for you, Johan, as we keep this look into the unknown future. We see, as I mentioned earlier, changes in the political landscape in the world. Your own native Sweden has recently seen quite a significant shift in government perspective. There's maybe a more nationalistic outlook amongst a number of governments, and it possibly poses a number of risks for travel and the airline sector, perhaps a closing world, you could say. Now, where for EasyJet's board does geopolitical risk sit on your risk register?
Well, first of all, we are a European airline, so we don't fly, as you know, outside Europe. But still, you know, you're certainly right to that extent that, you know, you see the nationalistic tendencies and closing borders, you know, being more prevalent now. But I do think, John, that this will go. It's like a, what do you say in English? Like a pendulum. It goes from one way to another. And there was a strong force for globalization here not long ago with all the benefits that created. And certainly, you know, that exposed some of the injustices when you have a globalization and you level things out. And then suddenly it becomes apparent for everybody that the wealth is very, you know, unequally distributed in the world. And then for various reasons, then, you know, you came into this perspective where, you know, you see more restrictions around borders and things becomes more complicated. But I think that's just going to go back the other way around, because ultimately there's too many benefits of using the world supply chains in a more efficient manner by open things up rather than the opposite. But I think that this is, you know, something that will just go back in the other direction at some point in time. Anyway, but there will always be geopolitical tensions. There will all be difficulties. And you know, the industry is not a stranger to that. We lived with that before, and we'll continue to live with that.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a good point to close on, Johan. I think we've had a good tour around both the landscape as we see it today and what that means for the shape of the industry and the challenges that may arise in the future. It's really been a great pleasure to talk through these issues with you today, Johan. So I'd like to thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, John.
So that's Johan Lundgren, CEO of EasyJet. A great discussion today. Thanks to Johan. Thanks to you for listening. I hope we've provided some valuable insight for you today into how EasyJet sees the future. I'll be back with the next in the series very soon. But for now, from me, John Strickland, goodbye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by our speakers are of their opinion and are not in any religion, ethnic group, organization, company, individual thing. AIG makes no representations as to accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series and will not be liable for any errors, omissions, or delays in this information, injuries, or damages arising from its use.